You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation. I want you to buckle up. I have a badass podcast in store for you with Parker Spencer. He's USA Triathlon's coach, and the things he's doing with lactate and, more importantly, testing are really pushing the paradigm for performance. I'm excited and want to extend this conversation with lactate, so we're going to get deep and understand how he's using this to effectively make the most dominant triathlon team on the Olympic landscape. So buckle up, Mr. Parker Spencer.
One of my big goals is to make sure that I'm on the forefront of where technology and exercise science is, and make sure that if we're doing things in an innovative way, then a lot of these guys who've been doing this for 30 years that I'm competing against, like my athletes will eventually surpass theirs, because a lot of those guys don't want to adapt. They don't want to know what the newest and greatest thing is out there. They just want to do what's worked for them and continue doing what they've done for 30 years.
Which, if you're not making moves to move forward or, implementing different things to try to keep them progressing, you're effectively going backwards.
100%. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can give you the whole backstory on kind of how we got.
Yeah, I love origin stories. So the one thing with this podcast has really been built on is, not only highlighting the amazing work, but and I want to get into VO2 max and lactate threshold. And, I'm really fascinated too with lactate clearance rates and do all that stuff, and how you guys, especially in three different modalities. I mean, able to swim and then go get on the bike. And now you're, talking about all this just concentric push and not eccentric load, but then getting off the bike and then going into the run, which is predominantly eccentric load. So I'm really fascinated by it, but I'd love to get into the origin and, more importantly, understand where you came from and how you got to this point.
Yeah, for sure. So, I've been doing this now, I think 13, 14 years. And once I really started getting into elite coaching, one of the things that I've always tried to do is use an exercise science lab to make sure that I understand really where my athletes are, so that we know what we need to do to take them from point A to point B and make sure that they're winning races. And so part of that is understanding the demands of competition. What do the best in the world look like? And then compared to where my athlete is today, and how can we use sports science and understanding all the way down to the metabolic level where they're at, so that we can just manipulate the training to get them closer to where the demands of competition are and they can win. Once I started with USA Triathlon in 2018, basically my program exists because our men have not been good at triathlon historically at the Olympic level. Our women have been multiple Olympic medals. I think we have 3 Olympic medals in women's triathlon, and triathlon's relatively a new sport. It's been around, the first Olympics was 2000, and we have yet to have a male individual medal in the Olympics. So we started my program in 2018. The goal was to keep our best young male triathletes in the sport and not go run D1 or swim D1, and they can continue to develop over these pivotal 18 to 22 year old years. And so I had them in a lab when we first started. I wasn't quite getting the data and what I really wanted out of that experience. And then we kind of fast forward to where we were this in 2023, and I felt like we had just had the best off season that my athletes had ever had. Really, really consistent, seeing some numbers in training that we haven't seen before. And then I took them all to a race in Cuba, and it was hot and humid, and I had 8 athletes there, and they all did terrible. And so I got on the plane, and I was frustrated with myself coming home, because if all of your athletes underperform, then most likely the athlete didn't do something wrong. I did something wrong as the coach in order to prepare them for that event. So I immediately reached out to a company called Human Powered Health, and they are putting exercise science labs all over the US. And those guys helped us out big time. And I basically said, hey, I'm not really getting in Arizona what I really feel like I need from a lab perspective. Is there a way that my athletes could work with you and we can understand, like, do some thermoregulation testing, do some lactate testing, do some VO2, and really understand, okay, where are they and why did they underperform in this race? And they were like, sure, let's look at the calendar, what works for you. Like, and they start giving me dates like 2-3 months out. And I was like, I'll be there next week if you let us come. So I took everyone to Minneapolis. We did 4 days of like very detailed thermoregulation testing, hydration testing, VO2, lactate. And then from that experience, I wanted to start working with a physiologist that understood it better than anybody else in endurance sports. And so I started working with a physiologist in Switzerland named Sebastian Weber. And Sebastian, a lot of his research is in metabolic profiles and blood lactate testing and understanding what those numbers mean and how to manipulate training to get to basically help an athlete improve. And that's basically just taken my whole approach with training to a completely new level. And we went from that first race of the year being a total bust to the most successful development program in the world last year. And we had incredible result after incredible result. We put three boys in the top eight in the world championships, and no country's done that since 2012 with Great Britain. We had athletes winning races in the off-road triathlon scene. We had para triathletes winning races. Like, we basically had a wide spectrum of different events that our guys were competing in. And all of it kind of stems back to the lactate and VO2 testing that we were doing, understanding what those numbers actually mean. And what I see a lot in my sport is you get an athlete in a lab and you take a bunch of videos and it looks really cool on Instagram, but how do you actually use that information to manipulate the training and make the athlete improve? And are you just using it as a benchmark, or are you actually using it to manipulate training and change things up for the athlete?
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to FieldStrong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/FieldStrong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show. So let's dig in. Like, how did you train? I mean, you know, like, VO2 max testing is, I would assume, is like the gold standard. But I also know that for like the bike, you know, like the wattage, I think it's like wattage per kilometer or like kilogram. Yeah. And I know somewhere around 6 is considered the gold standard, even though now you got guys on the tour approaching 7.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So obviously, like you mentioned, like, triathlon is a dynamic sport where you're basically doing three sports, and it's not like they're three separate things. One affects the other. And so when we just break down the testing and what we're doing, there's three main things that we're testing for. Their aerobic capacity, which is VO2 max, their anaerobic capacity, which has a popular way of saying that now is VLA max, which is like how quickly you produce lactate and the rate at which you produce lactate. That has been something, especially I think over the last 5 years, that exercise scientists have a much deeper understanding for. And so VO2 max in relation to VLA max. And we're not saying anaerobic threshold with that. We're saying anaerobic capacity. because those two numbers, VO2 max and VLA max together, that's what makes someone's threshold. And then the other is economy. And so you can have the fittest athlete in the world, but if they're not economical, then they're not going to perform at a high level. So when we look at training for the water and in the pool, water is 900 times the density of air. So basically what I mean by that is technique matters more than anything in the water. And you have to be fit, but I can have an athlete with a VO2 max in the 80s with terrible swim technique, and they're going to still almost drown. And so that's why you wouldn't take like someone who's winning marathons in the Olympics and throw them in the pool, and they're not going to be Michael Phelps. And I've started using this software system called Inside. And Inside is one of the only software systems in the world that you can actually take all this metabolic data and put it in, and it gives you a usable way to take that data and put it into training. And so through different protocols that we use with blood lactate testing, and then the metabolic cart that I use is a Cosmed K5 because I want it to be portable. Lab testing has its purpose, no doubt. And we get a ton of great information from the lab. But with what I'm doing, the most important thing for me to do it is in the field. But if I can take lab level equipment like the Cosmed K5 and take it outside and use it in the field, then I get much more usable data. Because think about VO2 testing on a treadmill. You're assuming, like, if one of the things that we want to get is VO2 max at velocity. So I want to know what pace that they're going when they hit their VO2 max. And if I'm doing that on a treadmill, you're assuming the treadmill is 100% accurate. And in reality, like, those things get out of calibration all the time, whether you have the gold standard with a Woodway or whatever. So we go through like several different protocols between the three sports. With swimming, I'll have the athlete go through several different efforts in the water that we prescribe, and we can change it up on the spot based off where their blood lactate is. So the goal is to get a good spread in the data. I don't want them to do just four efforts all at the same speed, because I'm basically going to get the same lactate number from all four. And as long as I make sure that they're recovering quick enough between the different efforts. So we start out, and it's essentially like a ramp test, where we start out at an easy effort, get what their blood lactate is, and then they do another effort. The goal is to make sure that we get their blood lactate below 3.5 before they get back in the water and start their next interval. But one of the unique things that I feel like we're doing is, as the athlete stops on the wall after each effort, I'm also taking the Cosmed K5 and putting it on their face for a minute and getting how they're recovering over that minute from a gas exchange standpoint. And then it's going to sound complicated, but it's really not. Like, after I put all that data in a spreadsheet, then I do reverse extrapolation, and it gives me very accurately what their VO2 was during that effort in the water.
Mm.
And that method's been out since the 1980s, so it's nothing too crazy. But
you're not doing like a finger prick or anything, or, you know, the earlobe?
So I'm doing both. So I'll have the Cosmed on them, and then at the same time, normally what I do is, if I have to do it by myself, the athlete's just holding the mask on themselves once they hit the wall. But I normally have someone else there to help me, and they're putting the mask on while I'm getting blood lactate from their ear at the same time. And then we get several different data points that we measure with the blood lactate. And then after I go through the whole protocol and there's a maximal effort at the end, then we take that information, put it in the Inside software, and it gives me what their VO2 max is, their VLA max, and it gives me their swimming economy. And the interesting thing about the software is I can take two athletes and compare them side by side. I can also take a test I did with someone in November and compare it to where they're at today and see if they've improved or if whatever I had them do actually made them worse.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
Wow. Would you say, like, the point you made about swimming is interesting. It's almost probably easier to take somebody that's adept at swimming and teach them to run more so than it is to take a runner and teach them to swim.
Yeah, and that's something that we've experienced a lot. It's interesting. You kind of have to find a, like, triathletes are kind of like that are really good between all three sports, which is basically where our sports evolved to now. It used to be find a fast runner that has a swim background from high school and then teach them how to ride a bike. In order to be good at the sport now, you have to be world class at all three. Like, most of these athletes could make an Olympic trials, maybe even an Olympics, and swimming and running and cycling. And so my job from a recruitment standpoint gets harder and harder. But as the popularity of our group and as the success of our team has gone up, the recruitment's actually become easier. Like, the athletes are willing to give up full ride scholarships to go run at world-class universities to come here and train with us and do this triathlon thing. So the runners tend to be terrible swimmers if you're just a pure runner, because of all the stuff that I'm sure that you guys deal with a lot when it comes to, like, with running, there's a certain level of muscle tightness and muscle tension that you really want. And so most of the time, if you get a runner on a table with a physical therapist, if they're a great runner, the PT is going to talk all about how tight they are and how they need to stretch more and all of that. Like, to a degree, yes, but a lot of that is what makes them, and that stiffness is what makes them a good runner. And in swimming is the total reverse. You want to be extremely flexible in swimming, and the more flexible, like, if you ever watch Michael Phelps, like, warm up, like, he can wrap his entire arms around himself. Like he's extremely, extremely flexible. So there's
Just like anthropomorphic ratios. You look at Michael Phelps, he's got like a 32-inch inseam.
Yeah.
He's got like huge feet. I mean, this long deal, long arms. I mean, he looks like, I think it was, what's the girl's, Gradaki?
Yep.
Ledecky. Oh my God. Yep. Seeing her walk on land, it looks uncomfortable. Like, she's so amazing in the water, but yet as a land-based person, like, you think how she doesn't blow her knees back. And I think I saw something where her knees actually hyperextend anywhere from like 18 to 20 degrees, which allows her to get greater whip and kick on the water. So they were talking about, like, just, you know, there's a certain genetic adaptation that's allowed her to swim at the rate she does. But for a field sport athlete or somebody that has to run, like, you would blow ACLs.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why it's a little bit of a give and take with the athletes that we do recruit and that we do have in the program, where, like, you win the race on the run. And so you can be the best swimmer in the field, and those guys don't normally win. But as, like, really since the Rio Olympics in 2016, our sports evolved rapidly. And now you have the guys who are front pack swimmers that are also the best runners in the field. And so I think it all comes down to, it's really one of the reasons that I reached out to Tom Newman at CSPAR is because there's a from a running economy standpoint, there's a lot of things that I want to improve in my group, but the strength training program for a triathlete is not what it should look like for a runner and not what it should look like for a swimmer. And so there's, and even some of the data that we got back, he was like, he's like, the things that we're seeing from the gait analysis and their hip angle, he's like, there's like, it's so far off of the standard, and every single one of your athletes has the exact same tilt, pelvis tilt. And I was like, well, that it's because they ride their bike 14 hours a day or a week. And so like there's adaptations that come from riding your bike as much as they do, running as much as they do, swimming. And it's basically, I want to find where their injury threshold is. I don't want them to get hurt. I want to find out what the line is on where they get hurt. And I want them to train just under that and maximize their training as much as we can. And that's a fine line.
Yeah, no, that's what Tom and I were talking about, was about the strength training component. And the thing which I brought up to him is, you're talking about athletes that are always in a sagittal plane. Everything is about forward. They're swimming forward, they're running forward, they're biking forward. So when you start seeing people that only move in this direction and they don't move in two other planes of motion, you know, they're also going to be very specific to that. So, you know, when we look at training athletes in terms of sport, whether it be football or, you know, lacrosse or whatever it is, you're talking about athletes that work in a 360 degrees and three different planes of motion, different axes of rotation. And there really is no axes of rotation. They're rigid swimming in this. I mean, there's no transverse plane. So they're going to be very specific and very adept at what they do, and looking, you know, using the model that we have, one of, you know, athleticism, the ability to move in that 360s and change direction. It's not a benefit to them for their sport, but it might be beneficial for them as just developing, you know, whole athleticism. And when we were talking about it, I'm like, maybe they just need to just maybe lift a little bit of weights and see if they get better.
Totally.
You know, it can't be complicated.
No. Yeah. And that's kind of the nice thing, is like, you're taking in an extremely fit athlete, and I don't really feel like we have to do much. Like, we're not trying to make them bodybuilders or professional weightlifters or anything like that. We're just trying to make sure that they're stable and that and efficient, and they don't get hurt. And so, and what you said was spot on. One of the problems that we see is like, hip stability is a big problem, because since you're just running in one direction and you're just going forward, then that lateral side to side movement doesn't really happen. One of the things that we've incorporated over the last couple of years is trail running for that reason, because with trail running, you have to, it's a lot of lateral movement, keeping yourself in the trail and all the turns and going uphill and downhill. And then what we've seen in return from that is not many injuries at all. And then we've also thrown our athletes into some more off-road type competition. And Sullivan Middall was third at the World Championships overall last year, against the best athletes in the world. And he's training on a road bike most of the time. So it's, one of the things I try to do is I want these guys to have different experiences within the realm of what we're doing as triathletes, because these guys are young. They're 18 to 21 years old. I want them to continue to let the sport to stay exciting and fun. And, when we were in Boston doing some of this testing at CSPAR, I entered them into a track meet at Boston University. And one of the interesting things, since we tested all these athletes using the Inside protocol and going through the Inside software in October, and then took all that information, built their entire offseason off of that information. One of our guys dropped 48 seconds on his 5K, another one almost a minute, and then another one 30 seconds. And we're not talking about someone who's going from like 20 minutes to 19. Like, they went from like just under the 15 minute 5K mark to right at 14 minute 5Ks. And so it's been pretty eye-opening understanding the blood lactate piece of all of it and how to use that to manipulate training.
Well, you also have to remember, I mean, it seems like just about, I mean, 10 years ago, people were still talking about lactic acid and the burning in your legs. I mean, it's pretty amazing that we've known about lactate for so long, and it was so misdiagnosed and almost misunderstood for so long. And now we understand lactate is a fuel. And I mean, still to this day, I'll hear people like, oh, my legs are burning the lactic acid. And I'm like, it's not a real thing.
Right. And,
but it's a misconception that's been around for 200 years. It's like even like on like muscle building, for example, hypertrophy. I mean, for a long time, they thought there were different mechanisms, like, you know, the age old, like you break your muscles down and it's a scarring effect. And muscles rebuild based upon that breaking down, which now based upon some research from probably 6 months, a year ago, that's not the case. That's not necessarily the effect. I mean, muscles grow in response to like mechanical tension and mechanical failure. Like they can't do something, so they grow bigger to be able to accomplish a task. I'm sure a lot for your sport in terms of like running, swimming and biking, which people have been doing for, you know, probably coming up on 100 years. I don't know when they first kind of put triathlons together. But, you know, I think what most people are familiar with isn't necessarily the Olympic distances. It's more like what happens at the Ironman and Kona, which is It's like a marathon run, 100 plus mile ride and, you know, 3 mile swim. Whereas these are kind of short sprints, which I think was it just like just under a mile, just under 25 mile bike ride and then a 10K run.
Right. Yeah. So we, and based off someone's metabolic profile, depending on what they're doing, those numbers need to be much different because of exactly what you said. Lactate gets a bad rep, but lactate is fuel and it's fuel for the anaerobic system. And so the higher rate that an individual can produce lactate, the higher their glycolytic power is and the more of a sprinter that they're going to be. And so the shorter the race, the higher you want your VLA max and you want your anaerobic capacity. And then the longer the race, the lower you want that to be, because like an Ironman, fat oxidation is really like the key to winning the race and doing it as fast as you can. So you want to keep blood lactate very low because you don't want to use up all the glycogen stores and everything you have in your muscles and your liver. And so I train both athletes. Well, my primary job is training USA Triathlon's future Olympians. I also work with some professional long course triathletes and some high level amateur triathletes that are doing Kona, and now they're doing some big races in Nice as well. And they have the world championship kind of go back and forth between Nice, France, and then now Kona. So you want their aerobic capacity. The thing that's interesting is a lot of people think like one affects the other. And the key is you want your aerobic capacity to be as high as you possibly can, whether you're a sprinter or you're an Ironman.
Or just a human. I mean, right.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, if you look at longevity, I mean, the people that have the highest aerobic capacity, I mean, obviously anaerobic and lifting weights and being strong is important. But I mean, based upon a lot of the current research, you know, the bigger your aerobic capacity, the greater, you know, chance you have for longevity and survival.
Yeah, exactly. And then with our sport at the Olympic level, it's even more complicated, because think of it being like a lot of people, like you said, when they think triathlon, they think Kona, and they think everyone with these weird, like pointy helmets and down in these crazy looking bikes. And that's not the Olympic level. The Olympic level is on road bikes and it's big packs. Looks a little bit more like a Tour de France peloton than it does when you're tuning into NBC watching the Ironman.
Well, it's also like a different age. So whenever I look at and watch Kona, I always feel like those athletes are usually in their like 30s and 40s and even in their 50s. They look like just kind of gristled beef jerky.
Yeah.
And then when you watch, like when I was watching clips of like the Olympic triathlon, they just all look like young kids that are like functioning at like 99.9% for the whole time. It's like a dead sprint. So it was just a very different athlete. Looks like they probably maybe start in the Olympic stuff. And then as they start to age out of the Olympics, they probably move this way as they become just 100%. Probably more adept.
Yeah. Cause as we get older, it's harder to maintain a certain level of speed and speed starts to drop. And so, but what these athletes have learned is that they can prolong their professional triathlon career by just going longer. And so you typically see people stay in the Olympic format till their 30s. And then once they hit like early to mid 30s, then they move on to the long course format. And then they continue their pro career through their 40s and can still be winning at the highest level in their mid 40s. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Even someone who looks at this data every day, it's crazy to see what some of these athletes are able to hold for a certain amount of time. For example, I had one of my guys, he has a sponsorship with Coros. So part of his sponsorship is he has to wear the heart rate monitor and the watch for all of his competitions. He has to collect that data and then they get access to his data. Well, I see his data with all that as well, of course. And he just ran 14:08 at Boston University for 5K. His heart rate hit 199 at minute 3, and he held it there all the way through the race until he went 204 on the last lap. And it's like to think about someone holding their heart rate at basically 200 beats per minute for 12 minutes, I was looking at all of it and I was like, holy cow. I just like even training this guy for a long time, it's like to be able to hold your heart rate at that high for that long is pretty impressive.
What do you think his max heart rate was? I mean, is his max heart rate 221 and he's able to hold that? Is he able to hold 90% or is it like?
The highest that we've ever gotten him even in maximal tests is 206. So he's basically able to maintain like 98% of like his max heart rate for over 10 minutes. So wow. Yeah, pretty insane.
Damn. And if anybody's ever done any heart rate kind of max heart rate testing, and you know, like when you hit that like upper threshold, there's like a weird feeling of like, my heart's going to explode. I might die. Your body is trying to shut down. And the fact that he can get into that state and move as fast as he can, it's pretty impressive.
Well, and I mean, the realist in me is like,
okay, is this healthy?
is that healthy? And two, is it accurate? And like, can he really do that? So then 2 weeks later, we went back and did it again. He basically he dropped like just a few seconds on his 5K time, ran even faster, same exact heart rate profile through the whole thing. So,
is the, when you're selecting the athletes, and I'm sure you get a huge pool of applicants and people coming in, mm-hmm. is VO2 max kind of the gold standard for that? Or is it something where you're like, hey, I can develop VO2 max if they have these other intangible skills? Or is it really just a person by person basis, like this guy's got intangibles, we can develop him? Or I'm just kind of curious to know if, I mean, I'm sure you put them through a battery of testing. If they don't meet certain things, they don't have the capacity for it, but
yeah, it's a big part of it. It's part of the equation, not all of it, but like if I have someone come to me and like everyone's required to do a VO2 max test and use the protocol that I send them. And then I want to learn about the treadmill that they're using and what metabolic cart and all that. Ideally, they come here. Like if I'm really interested in them, they come here and I put them through the test myself on the equipment that I have. And if you have a VO2 max in the 50s, then the reality is no matter how bad you want it, it's just not going to happen. And if you have a VO2 max in the 60s, then I'm interested. If it's in the 70s, I'm really interested. If it's in the 80s, then like now we're really talking. And But the other piece to that,
what determines that? I've always been fascinated. Yeah. Like, is it a exposure training as a younger athlete? Is it just genetic? Is it like kind of a, you know, metabolic something that happens? Like, we did some VO2 max testing when I played in the NFL, and like some guys were like grossly low to the point where like we didn't know how they were alive, and other guys were through the roof, and it just happened that they were really efficient and they did well at their jobs, and you know, they could you know, play a couple things, and other people were off the charts, and so there really wasn't a like a spectrum where you were like, oh wow, like I guess you could play the VO2 max wasn't that important. But I was always curious to know like why certain people were higher than others, and more importantly, how you it like what's the percentage of trainability that you can maximize.
I think like one of the things we're understanding a whole lot more, especially over the last decade, is how much that is trainable, and that you can, there's quite a bit that an individual can do to improve their VO2 max by a lot. Genetics is obviously a huge piece of it. And so, like, just like how we kind of talked about with Katie Ledecky and Michael Phelps, they're extremely hard workers. They did a lot of I'm sure they did the right training and everything in order to have the success that they did, but they are also incredibly genetically gifted at the same time in order to get to that point. Genetics is probably one of the biggest roles in that, but then the amount of training that you've done, also the environment that you've lived in. Like you see kids that live at altitude, they have much higher VO2 maxes than others. When I'm testing them, a big part before they're accepted into the program, I want to know what their VO2 max is, but I also want to know how they got to that VO2 max. So if they're 17 years old and they're beating all their peers, but then you look and they're training double or triple what their peers are, there's not a lot that I can do with that. Like if someone's already training 30 hours a week and they have a VO2 max in the 70s, 80s, the amount of improvement that I can make on that person is not nearly as much as someone whose VO2 max is in the 70s or 80s and they've been running 20 miles a week versus 80. And so I'm really looking for someone who has a very good VO2 max, but didn't do a ton of training to get to that point. And because it's honestly, it makes my job way, way easier. All I have to do is safely build their volume and you're already going to see improvement.
All right. So we got VO2 max, lactate threshold. We got into a little bit of the VA max. What was it?
VOA max.
Yeah. VOA max.
Yeah.
You know, lactate's fascinating. It's been misdiagnosed, but it's really this fuel. I mean, it's the brain's preferred fuel. So really just that like lactate bathing and getting these people ready for it. Is it really an issue of how much lactate they can produce? Like, I don't know what the upper registers are. When we were testing our guys, they were like 19 to 20 millimoles.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. And then, you know, it took them 4 minutes to clear down to like, you know, 5 or 6. Now that you shot me to 3.5, I'll probably push them down a little bit. But I definitely know the first time we got them that high, their cognition was off. So then Tom had me like chasing him around, asking him to, you know, spell their names and, you know, what's 5 plus 5? What street did you grow up on? And asking these questions. And by the end of it, they became pretty coherent just for the fact that they were used to it. But I need to probably do a lot more extensive testing with them. But is it a genetic factor or a training factor, how high they can get, and more importantly, a marker of fitness for how fast they clear?
Yeah, definitely. So you have, so this is where a lot of other people, kind of misunderstand this whole process too, where you have type 1 muscle fibers, but then you also have two different types of type 2 muscle fibers. One of those are just like what you're born with, and the other one is highly trainable and can function more slow twitch or function more fast twitch.
We call those the schizophrenic fibers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I call them schizophrenic.
And what we do in training, like what we're honestly really doing is we're trying to train those muscle fibers to act the way that we want them to. We can have a, in the past, there's been, in order to understand if an athlete has more type 1 or type 2, you have to do a muscle biopsy. The problem with muscle biopsy is you're only taking a sample of one part of the body. You're not doing a muscle biopsy of the whole body. And so even that can be inaccurate. But one of the things that again, in the last 5 years that, and there's some white papers written on this specifically by Sebastian Weber on, you can take blood lactate results and correlate that with muscle fiber type. And you can basically understand where someone is from a muscle fiber standpoint, just purely based off looking at their blood lactate. So when you talk about lactate threshold, VO2 max plus VLA max equals someone's lactate threshold. So you got to look at someone's aerobic capacity, their anaerobic capacity, and that is what gets you to your threshold. So I can have the exact same, I can have you and I, like, let's just use bike wattage, for example. You and I could have the exact same lactate threshold on the bike. And that, let's just call that 300 watts. But how I get to that 300 watts is likely going to be very different how you get to that 300 watts. And that again, even in our world of triathlon, that's widely misunderstood. The way that people test for threshold is like a typical test that's been around for years. A 5 minute hard effort on the bike, 10 minutes easy, and then 20 minutes as hard as you can go. You get that wattage number, take 95% of it, and then boom, you get your threshold. But that doesn't really help me as a coach know what I need to change with their in their training to make that threshold go up. I need to understand, where is their VO2 max? Where is their VLA max? And what do we need to do to change that? And so what we've looked at with our athletes, we went through all this testing, and I essentially have like three different groups for each sport. I have someone who needs to raise their aerobic capacity. I've got someone who needs to raise their anaerobic capacity, or someone who's pretty balanced out between both of them, and we can raise both. And so even though I'm coaching athletes in person every day in a group environment, it's a very individual approach. And we may go to the track and there may be five different workouts going on for 10 people.
So you're actually looking at not training them all the same and throwing them into the same model. You're looking at trying to find like where the weak link is and then pull up each person, almost like looking at like, I guess, a stereo EQ, and you're trying to turn it up to make the perfect sound for each individual athlete.
Totally. And I was telling someone the other day, I feel like, however you want to describe it, I feel like I have like I've cracked the code with it. The more that I understand how to use blood lactate and gas exchange data, because it clearly lays it out for me. All right, here's what I need to do to make the athlete improve. And then on the track, like we'll test on the road or the track for running, and I'll get gas exchange, I'll get blood lactate, put all that together. And then I also like the economy piece is really important. And that's what made me reach out to Tom and those guys at C-SPAR to begin with, because I've got athletes with VO2 maxes. Most of the guys are in the low 80s. And we didn't have to do a lot to get them to that point. And so their capacity for improvement is huge. But I see they've got like their VO2 and their VLA is pretty much exactly where I'd want it. But then I'm like, okay, why are they not running faster? And then we look at their running economy data and they're not economical. And so there's the whole strength piece to it. And what do we need to do from a gait analysis and strength training standpoint to make sure that like basically we want the chassis to be able to actually use the engine. And the engine's big, but if the chassis is not strong, then they're not going to succeed nearly at what they're capable of.
How are you measuring the economy? I mean, that's really comes down to like technique. Is it video where they're just looking for inefficiencies, or you know, maybe the force bleed effect?
So there's a lot of research out there and algorithms and everything else where you could take no lactate, no VO2, and go to the track and run a 800 or a mile or something like that, and then based off what your time is for that, then it gives you a predicted VO2 max. And what that doesn't take into consideration is your economy. And so what we do is we use those algorithms and that predict VO2 max based off of the distance that you ran and the time that you ran it in. And then we compare it to the real-time VO2 max data that we're getting from the COSMED K5. And then based off those two numbers, someone's running if they're running an 800 and their time with the 800 shows that their VO2 max is 70, but then we put the COSMED on and their VO2 max is 82, then they're not economical. And so there's a standard in the inside software that we use with Division One distance runners is the standard that they've put in the software. And so we compare where our athletes are to them, and it gives me a graph on kind of where they're at. And then again, what I can do is I can actually take one athlete and compare it to another, or I can test an athlete in 1 month and then the next month test them again and put that economy data together and see if we've actually helped them become more economical. So where like the force plate stuff has become really popular with running. And that's a lot of what we did at CSPAR was a lot of force plate testing and really measuring the stiffness and the elasticity and everything within each athlete to make sure that if they're, it's kind of the same thing that we've spoken about with these swimmers, like it's the same reason Michael Phelps is also not a world-class runner, because of muscularly, there's a lot of different things going on there. But I've got kids that I want to be able to qualify for an Olympic trials in swimming if we really wanted them to, but also be able to do the same thing in running and make them a triathlete. Mm.
Is that a hard proposition for them? I mean, if they could go and focus on one task opposed from trying to master these three disciplines?
No, because like, I think like with distance running, like you tell someone, like let's take Morgan Pearson, for example. Morgan's the best male triathlete in the US and arguably one of the best male triathletes we've ever had in the US. He was already like a 1330 5K runner when he became a triathlete. 1330s, like that's really solid. Yeah. But he's not, he's like 45 seconds off of an Olympic medal. Like, yeah. And when you're already running that fast, that's a world apart. So could he have a good chance of maybe qualifying for an Olympics? Like he needs to run under 13 minutes to likely qualify for an Olympics, but like through training at his age, he probably could have done that. But is he going to win a medal? Like it's going to be much harder for him to win a medal than someone like him who had a swim background, specifically an open water swim background, and switched to triathlon. And then he hasn't won an individual medal, but we also have a mixed team relay in the Olympics where there's four athletes, two men, two women. They all do a super sprint triathlon. And the US won a silver medal in Tokyo. And Morgan just qualified for Paris as the first male to qualify for us.
So what you're doing is it's kind of similar to like the decathlete almost. You know, they find pretty good runners and people that can pole vault and kind of do a little bit of everything. And they're probably generally good at everything. And not amazing at any one thing. And so that's why they get to be triathlete or decathletes. Interesting, totally. Dude. Because the training stimulus is so different between the bike and the run. Do you find that, because you think about all concentric, push, 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 that position of being on the bike and then getting into the run. Do you find like injuries happen for the fact that these guys are so concentric in the push and then they get into something like the running where there is such a massive eccentric load? And they're not really running, they're sprinting. It's like, like what was it, the Boston Marathon? Was it this that they just ran?
The Olympic trials they just ran.
Yeah, and I was watching it. And, like, the dudes were sprinting, like, for, 24 miles. Like, it was 26 miles. Like, it was amazing. And, like, the guy ran mile two as fast as he ran, like, mile 19. Like, it was, like, 4 minutes. And, like my head was exploding, like, watching these guys run. And they're, like, they're in the last mile. And they get done. They can go keep going. So,
yeah, it's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, well, honestly, a lot of reasons that people get into triathlon is they're injured runners that get into it. Like, because then when they get injured running, they have to do some type of other cross training. And so they're swimming or biking to try to stay in shape while they recover. And then they realize that they like the cross training aspect of it. I don't really think we see many injuries necessarily from running off the bike, but what you do see is quite a bit of a diminishing return between like you see a pretty big fatigue factor from people who aren't well trained between the bike and the run, where normally we'd want to see like a 3% difference between your open 5K time and then your triathlon 5K time. But those who aren't trained well, like, it'll be much, much bigger. One of the interesting things that we've started doing with blood lactate as well is we also, with this testing, we understand what their peak lactate combustion rate is as well. So at what effort between swimming, biking, and running are they clearing lactate at the quickest rate? And you would think, okay, if you just had a really hard push on the bike, I'm going to now sit in the back of the bike and then recover and just recover at 100 watts. It's actually, most athletes are much more efficient at a higher wattage than you would think at clearing lactate. And if you're just, and think about like, you run an all out 400 on the track and then you just stand there, like, you need to clear all that lactate out of your system so that you can then go back and do it again quick enough. And so jogging in between reps is a whole lot better than just standing around or sitting down on the ground. Same thing in these races where, like, if I have athletes that are in a breakaway, so that we just did this over the weekend. We put our guys in a cycling race just to work on some cycling tactics before we go into the first triathlon of the year. And one of our athletes was in a breakaway and in a road race, really hard effort on the front. And then when he got back into the group and when it was time to recover, instead of sitting right on the back of the person's wheel and having an easier ride, he moved himself just off to the side so he could push 240 watts versus 100, because he knows that 240, his body's more efficient at clearing lactate than it is at 100. So then when it is his time to push again on the front, then he had the power and the ability and the energy to do that. And this is a really new concept. I don't think anybody's really understanding it like that, especially in triathlon. And now we've had a lot of key workouts using this method, and our guys understand race strategy is a big part of being able to get off the bike and their blood lactate being as low as possible so that they can run to their best of their ability.
What's the, I keep thinking about it almost like a container. So there's a certain amount of intensity that they have to add in that, and the lactate gets produced. Is there, an upper threshold where all of a sudden they hit a certain number and they can't go past it? And that's kind of like they're peaking out and kind of maxing the top of that container.
Yeah. And each person is different with that. So When we do max lactate testing, I've got some athletes that can't get their blood lactate above 8. And then I've got others that they peak at like what you were talking about earlier, like 20. And like the athlete that can't peak really above 8, he's much more efficient at using fat as fuel versus the athlete that their blood lactate's at 20. Then they're really efficient at using glycogen as fuel.
Which would be metabolic flexibility, you know, your ability to move between both fat. But I guess it just comes down to, I mean, is that a function of diet or is it just really just training adaptation?
Both. So there's a lot of research on both where if I want, like, I don't want an athlete to get their blood lactate to 20 that I'm training, because once you do that and you're burning through glycogen stores like crazy and you can't eat enough without bonking, and they're going to bonk and then they're going to be totally out of energy. And like, it's going to be a struggle to just get to the finish line. But I also don't want them to have a super low anaerobic capacity, because a lot of what we're doing in this style of triathlon racing, you have to have a stronger anaerobic system as well. So, but diet does play a big role into it, where if you're eating a whole lot of carbs and you're on a high carb diet, then that's going to, it's all metabolism, and everything that we're doing with both training, eating, all of it, it's metabolism, and it's basically understanding what your metabolism is and what you need to do to improve it to perform better.
So each individual has their own kind of custom diet. Like, instead of being like, oh, everybody here is going to have a low carb, high fat diet because that works good for endurance, opposed from like a standard westernized or 60% carbohydrate kind of a deal. But I got to imagine, especially in this glycolytic threshold, you know, like, I mean, they have to be eating a decent amount of carbohydrates. I think it would suck to be forced to do that and not be eating carbohydrates.
Yeah. So with my Ironman athletes, they're on a low carb, high fat diet, because we want them to be able to use as much fat as fuel in a competition. And if you learn how to do it really well, you don't have to really eat a ton during a 10-hour race. But with the guys that I'm coaching at this short, intense format, carbs are king, and like you got to be able to stomach 80 plus grams of carbs per hour in order to make sure that you have what it takes to have energy to win the race at the end.
Well, they're also young too. I mean, you know, there's pretty good data that, like, when you're young, you can probably handle more carbohydrate, and as you age, you know, you lose some ability to process carbohydrate. But also you look at the energy demands. I mean, people that are younger just tend to move more. I mean,
totally.
You know, and especially these guys, 18 to 22 years old, I mean, they're like rubber. You can probably just hit them with a bat and repeated efforts and they're good to go. And you look at that same athlete in 20 years and you got to be a lot more conscious of it. Do you think that there's any of this data or anything that extrapolates out into, like, you know, a way, like, towards, you know, health and longevity, or more importantly, looking at like other sports and other athletes? I mean, you guys are so specific in what you're doing, but as I'm sitting here wondering, how do we extrapolate this or use this for other sports where, I don't know, like field sports or power sports, where, you know, that's what Tom and I've been talking about. Like, is lactate going to be as big an issue for, let's say, like, I guess like wrestlers, it would be huge, but like football players and whatnot.
Totally. I mean, think about the last 2 minutes. I mean, think about the Super Bowl and like just how crazy that, like, the last quarter was. And I mean, I think a big strategy that people have in football, and you would know this better than me, I'm the endurance guy over here trying to tell you about football, but that a lot of the strategy some of these teams have is like, no huddle, like keep the tempo as fast as you can and wear the other team out, and that they're just going to be tired. And I think a big part of that is like, think about if you're a safety or a tailback or whatever, and your blood lactate is like now at like 10 plus millimoles, and you got a receiver who's like trained a certain way, and they're standing on the line and their blood lactate is one, like who's going to out sprint the other and be able to actually like go after, and same thing with a running back and all of that. So I think blood lactate, here's the reality. Continuous blood lactate monitors, like they're the future, and they're already out. They're like in testing and everything right now. You're going to be able to see real-time blood lactate data instead of having to prick someone's ear, prick someone's finger. It'll be just like one of those Super Sapiens type glucose monitors.
Like the diabetics wear, you know, CGMs, and it's the same collection. So when I ordered the lactate tester, my son's type one. So it's the same glucose meter we have. It just, you know, strips and the whole deal. It just, you know, creating that curve and really just understanding like, all right, like this is what you are pre, like, you know, before we work, after we work, and then, you know, at different intervals to be able to go back, to be able to create kind of a lactate curve, I think.
Yeah.
That's where, that's probably where I'm going in this next training cycle with these guys, just because I'm fascinated to see, you know, age, diet, and all these other factors. So it'd be a great indicator.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think I would say in the next year, I think you're going to start seeing these on the market. And just how in cycling, when the power meter came out, like that was innovative and new. Now you can't coach a cyclist without a power meter effectively. Like, I think 5 years from now, maybe even sooner, that's what we're going to see with continuous lactate monitoring. You're not going to be able to coach an athlete effectively without using it, because if your competitors have that advantage and they know they have that information, like it just changes the whole game. It changes like their ability to be able to know when they can attack and when they can put a move in. And like if one of my guys looks down at their Garmin and they see their blood lactate's 8.0, then they're like, okay, yeah, I'm not going to be like, it's going to be hard for me to actually make a move here. But if they look down and they're at like 2 millimoles, then they're like, all right, I got a wide range of being able to put a big attack in here and be able to hold it. And so I think everything that we're doing with blood lactate testing right now, I feel like it's pretty accurate, but we're assuming that what we've gotten in testing is also what we're seeing on race day. And the reality is there's a lot of other factors playing in on race day, and you can't underscore what stress and stress hormones and all of that do to the body as you're going into. And that's why we do a lot of mental skills testing and stuff as well, because if you can control your mind in every aspect, like you're going to likely be able to physically perform better. And there's net, like in research, they call it the psychobiological model of endurance performance is what you see a term like that used a lot. And a lot of people look at, okay, there's the mind and then there's the body. But then once you start to understand that it's actually one, and the mind affects the body and the body affects the mind, being able to use that together is really important in high performance.
Well, also, if the training is harder than the competition, like I know for when I played football, I wanted the training and I wanted practice to be harder than anything I saw on Sunday. So you could go in and realize like, all right, this isn't going to be as hard as what I saw this week. It wasn't as hard as what we did in training coming in. So I always feel like if your hardest day is on game day or on competition day, you probably need to ratchet up the intensity in your training. So that's why I never felt nervous. I mean, obviously nervous excitement to go play, but I never felt like what I was going to see on Sunday was worse than what I had during the week or even coming into it. So that was nice. Like it was a good piece to be able to go in and be like, all right, now I'm going to go just focus on trying to win.
Totally.
Man, that's awesome. I'm really excited actually to hear about all the force plus data. We just got a bunch of force plates from Tom sent over through his guys at, what is it? Something that, I'm totally flanking him on the name. On Dynamics, Hawkins Dynamics. We're about to get into all this jump force plate data. I'm really excited to kind of take this next leap and seeing if what we think is happening is really what is happening. And that's what I think is so fascinating with the force plate data. I mean, it just doesn't lie. Either you have it or you don't. And it kind of gives you an idea, a little bit of a roadmap, similar to what you're talking about with the lactate. Are we going in the right direction? If so, let's keep going this way.
Right. Well, I think you hear, like, I've heard this quote a couple different ways, but basically, like, what can be measured can be managed, or what can be measured can be improved. And so, like, a lot of like, I'm sure I get a ton of data every day that some of it's usable, some of it's not. But at the end of the day, like, we're collecting data, and like, data is a powerful thing. And being able to see where someone is one day and see how they've improved or even gotten worse and the next day, that should be information on what we can take into training and manipulate to make sure that they accomplish their goals.
Cool. Well, if people want to learn more, maybe get in touch with you and learn more about what you're doing or support USA Triathlon, how's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, so my email is parker.spencer@usatriathlon.org. I'm also on LinkedIn and all the social media platforms. So, and then they can also look up our program called Project Podium, both online or on social media. One of the things that we've done is I've got a full-time photographer, videographer with us every day. So you'll find all kinds of stuff on YouTube and Instagram and all that.
Just got to do it for the gram. You got to have that social media content presence.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I fucking hate it. Oh, well, that's why I have him doing it.
Yeah.
I was doing it and I was like, all right, I need someone else to do this. And yeah. It doubled our budget since we had him because of people knowing about it and donations and sponsors.
Yeah, it's the optics. Have to do it. Yeah. So, well, dude, I know you got a jam, so I'll end it there. But, dude, thanks for coming on. I'm pretty excited about everything that you guys are doing and to support it. So thanks for tuning in another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.